Yeah.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It is Shabbat, the 23rd of July, 2016. Welcome to Narkis Bible Study. You can sit here. I'd just like to be further away. We are continuing our study of the triennial parasha, which means reading through the Torah in 3 years, the old parasha, not the new one, and the one practiced in Jesus' day. And so our verses for today are Genesis 42, only the first 17 verses. And that puzzles me, but there it is. And Isaiah 55, the whole chapter, which is 13 verses. So I'm just going to write those up here quick. And what we can do is have people read it together. We'll read it together. We don't have that much text, so it works. Maybe we will start. Gemma, do you want to start for us?
Genesis 42, starting in verse 1.
Starting in verse 1.
When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other?" He continued, "I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die." Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm might come to him. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for there was famine in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. "Where'd you come from?" he asked. "From the land of Canaan," they replied, "to buy food." Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams about them and said to them, "You're spies. You've come to see where our land is unprotected." "No, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come to buy food. We're all sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." "No," he said to them, "you've come to see where our land is unprotected." But they replied, "Your servants were 12 brothers, the sons of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father and one is no more." Joseph said to them, "It's just as I told you, you're spies. And this is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your words may be tested to see if you're telling the truth. If you're not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." And he put them all in custody for 3 days.
All right. There you go.
There you go.
Stops kind of right in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Let us proceed to Isaiah 55. And maybe we'll continue down. We'll read in English. Do you have English or something else? Okay, would you like to read? You can read 5 verses or so, and then the next person can read.
"Come, everyone who is thirsty, come to the waters. And you without money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Why do you spend money on what is not food, and your wages on what does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me and eat what is good, and you will enjoy the choicest of foods. Pay attention and come to me. Listen so that you will live. I will make an everlasting covenant with you,
All right. So, what is our obvious connection here? The biggest connection?
Famine and food.
Famine and food. Okay. Specifically, shivru, buy grain, or buy food. That's in Isaiah 55:1. This is a word, go back to, or keep your finger in both. Sorry, what do you say?
Mine says if you're thirsty, come to get wine or milk, not grain.
I've got wine or milk, buy wine or milk.
Well, it uses the verb twice. Okay, for those, because some of you have heard some Hebrew, so I'll just read the verse in Hebrew. Hoy kol tzame lechu lamaim, v'asher en lo kasef, lechu shivru ve'echolu, ulechu shivru belo chesef, uvelo mechir yain v'chalav. So, it repeats the word shivru, which is normally, it's a verb that comes from the noun shever, which refers to grain, or what's that? What's the kind of farming people do when they don't sell it to other people? They use it themselves, subsistence.
Subsistence.
Shever is like the grain of subsistence. But it is specifically something you buy. It's an interesting word. I'll put it up here. This is our connected word. Because it also means breaking. So you can debate whether it's, we have it in the Joseph story, is breaking a famine. Or is it broken grain? Who knows? But it's definitely grain, and it's grain that people buy. Mashbir is the normal way to talk about selling grain.
That's the word just to break something. It's also
Lishbor.
So in a way, it's crushed grain. I mean, grain's no good until it's crushed or broken.
Sure, I mean, in a way you could say that. But who knows why it developed the way it did, I'm not sure. But Lishbor, we have in the Genesis one, we have the verb Lishbor, which also means to break. But it means to sell or to buy grain. Lehashbir is what Joseph does. I think the word also has lishbo for him. So two words related to this same word for buying grain, or the grain that you buy to eat. Do you guys know the mashbir?
Yeah.
The store in town? That comes from this word, hamashbir.
I thought
it
was.
No, it moved now, though, right? It doesn't. It's not there anymore.
That's not.
Right.
The old branch was right near Talita Kumi.
I thought it was a connection with the word.
It's connected to the word
emergency
shever.
or mashbir.
Mashbir is a crisis.
That's what I was told.
Yeah. But that's coming from the whole shever idea. Shever is also breaking. Sometimes words can be homonyms too.
To eat. To eat is something to eat.
Yeah.
Grain. Wheat.
Right.
But the other one is wine and milk. To drink.
Right.
So
right.
To eat applies wheat.
It's interesting because the thirsty gets sent to the water, but the one who doesn't have money go and buy. Shivru is the verb that comes from this grain word. So go buy grain and eat it, and go buy without money and without a price wine and milk. So,
isn't it a generic term? Why spend money on what's not bread? I mean, it's like bread is wine and milk and food and...
They're all treated together. Yeah. Treated in parallel.
Right.
So the command... But they use this word, shivu, shivu, several times. So if anybody wants it like this, shever. This is the same word. Shivu. This is the verb. Seems to be denominative, coming from the noun. So, buy for yourself grain, buy for yourself grain, or just buy for yourself. Obviously, wine and milk, it's even more than water, right? It would never be free. It would be something you would buy, similar to the grain that you live on. I guess in the case of a famine, or when you don't have enough grain for yourself, you buy grain. And that's our connection, one of the connections between the passages.
But the connection is that if you have a famine, the bread and the wine you're producing yourself.
You wouldn't be producing.
And you can't produce it because of the famine.
Right.
Here you've got a sort of spiritualized thing. Why go and buy? You know, you don't even have to go and buy it.
Right.
If there's a famine, it's a famine for the word of God. It's saying
like buy it without money. Basically buy it for free. It's a big discount right now. And not only the grain to live on, but even wine and milk. Wine and milk are not subsistence things, right? Bread and water is subsistence. Wine and milk are
the next stage up.
Extra. They're a next stage up. They might be the next few stages up. I don't know. So it's kind of stating the same thing again, but even exaggerating more. Like, not only are you going to live your basic subsistence, but even more, for free. So
I had a question in Genesis. Can I just ask, because it came out again when I was reading this now. Twice or three times it talks about the land being unprotected in my version. What's that in Hebrew, and what does it mean?
Yeah, okay, so we're going to get there in a second.
Okay, sorry.
But it's interesting, back in Genesis 42:1, why are you looking at each other? Some of you have been learning Hebrew with me, and we read a text about two kings who looked at each other in the face. What were they doing? They were meeting in war. So it's an interesting little thing. They don't have the same phrase. It doesn't say lama titra'u fanim, but it just says lama titra'u. Why are you looking at each other?
It's kind of like an idiot.
But I was just thinking to myself, it is funny, because what we know about Joseph's brothers, they're always arguing, right? Even when they all agree that they hate Joseph, they're arguing what to do with him. No, let's do this. No, don't do that. We should do this. And it seems like every time they're there, they're arguing with each other. So I just thought that was interesting. Take it or leave it. But in any case, why are you just sitting around looking at each other or sitting around arguing with each other? I have heard that there is shever b'mitzrayim. There is subsistence grain in Mitzrayim. Go down there and shivru lanu. Buy us some grain. And we will live. Let us live and not die. And that little phrase is interesting to me too. To live and not die. Because it... seems to be in a lot of places in the Bible where you have this contrast, you know, choose life and not death. Okay, so they go down to buy grain. Again, the same word, lishbor, and then bar is another word for grain, from Egypt. And they don't take Benjamin with us because they don't want a disaster happening to him like happened to his brother. And so verse 5, and his brothers, or the sons of Israel, come to buy grain. It's again, lishbor, not to break, to buy grain. along with the other ones who were coming, because there was a famine in the land of Canaan. Okay, and in verse 6, we are reminded that now Joseph was the ruler, or the governor, over the land. Interestingly enough, they use a late word for the word ruler. I don't know why.
What do you mean a late
Shalit,
word?
Shalit.
Oh.
Shalit is late Hebrew for ruler. Comes a lot in the book of Esther, Kohelet. It was an Aramaic loanword, and particularly when the Jews were in close contact to Aramaic bureaucracy, they got to know this word well. Even, if I remember from 20 years ago, I read an article by a guy named Sao, who dated the book of Esther based on this word, because he said this word was only used, it was a technical term in a certain period, sometime in the 5th century.
Right.
Anyway, here is the word. There it is. He's a leader over the land. And he is the one who sold the grain, Hamashbir, for all the people of the land. So his brothers come to Joseph, and they bow down their face to the ground. So that's a nice little fulfillment of what?
The dream.
So the dream, what are the elements of the dream?
Eleven stars,
and the sun and the moon.
Actually, I think it was only 10.
Are you sure?
Yeah, because Benjamin wasn't born yet.
I think it's 11. We just read it a couple weeks ago. Didn't we talk about this?
Well, if this is 10? If this is the fulfillment, then it's only 10.
Well, yeah, it doesn't say it's a fulfillment, but yeah. Because later on, Benjamin does eventually come down.
Right.
So either way, it could have been correct. Also, the sun and the moon. I mean, who's the moon? Because his mom's dead.
Wouldn't this be more of the dream of the sheaves?
That's the one we're talking about.
You're right. It was 11 stars.
Oh. They were given together. Two dreams at the same time. So there are 11 stars in one dream, sun and moon. And then there are sheaves, exactly, in the other dream. And that's even more connected because we're talking about grain here, and we're talking about bowing down. So they don't, of course, use the same word for grain. They're talking about sheaves that are bound up grain. And the details vary. I mean, who is the moon and who is the 11th star? Well, the 11th star comes later on in the story. This is not going to be the only time the brothers bow down to Joseph. This is the very first time. So verse 7, Joseph sees his brother and he recognizes them, but he pretends to be a foreigner to them. And he speaks to them harshly. And I guess he would be speaking Egyptian through a translator too, if he's really trying to be a foreigner. And so he says, "No, you guys didn't come down to buy for yourself food." He charges them of being meraglim, being spies. And it's also interesting that in verse 8 we have again that he recognized them, but they didn't recognize him, and he remembered his dreams, or the dreams that he dreamt about them. And so then he says, "You're spies." I don't know why remembering the dreams says you're spies, but I guess remembering the dreams, he's coming up with a plan to be able to get Benjamin down. That's the whole point. So
well,
you're spies, and then...
What's the significance of spies? Is it meraglim?
Meraglim, uh-huh. Because he's saying...
What's a spy? Why
you come
a spy?
To see the nakedness of the land. I don't know.
It's just a false accusation, right?
It keeps getting repeated. It's like, I mean, you get it in the world now, and you're being called, "Oh, you're a communist, you're a communist, you're a communist," or
"Well,
you're
a..." Well, it's a great way to accuse someone, right? If you want to throw them in jail, accuse them of being a spy.
Right.
Everyone acknowledges that's bad, and you can throw him in jail.
A kind of revenge.
What?
Kind of revenge.
Sure, sure, it could be revenge here. But it's part of his whole plot because he wants to get
Benjamin
down. And so how is he going to do it? He has to accuse them of something to throw them in jail, right?
Right.
So what's the easiest thing? Like if you just visit Iran today, what's the easiest thing to
accuse
you of? You're a
spy.
Let's throw you in jail.
You're a Mossad agent. Yeah, you're
sure,
a spy. Yeah,
sure.
Good. Thank you.
So
I could work out why.
And then he keeps using this little, you've come to see the nakedness of the land. Kind of a crass way to put it.
Well, go back to Iran. You've come to spy on our...
There's no what?
There's no defense to that charge also, because if you put out a good defense, they simply say, so you've just proved how good
a spy you are.
So then it makes the brothers restate in verse 10, no, we've come to buy food. Again, this buy food, what is this, the sixth time it's been mentioned? And so they have to justify their existence. We're all the sons of one man, and we are honest, upright people. We are not slaves. And he says, no, you've come to see the nakedness of the land. And so then they have to go into detail.
Somewhere there's a guilt trip around. I mean, they may not recognize Joseph, but they're telling this whole story about dad and the boy that's left behind, and one is missing. They know damn well what's happened to the missing boy. But there's a sort of guilt, element of guilt there, isn't there?
There's an element of guilt. I mean, that's developed later on in the story. But right here, they just have to justify who they are. And I guess there's 11 of them. It might be a foreboding group. And they're all coming together. They're full-grown guys, you know, you could be like a little troop of something.
Yeah.
And so to justify their existence, they say, hey, we're all just brothers. We're not really spies. We're just brothers. And to prove it, we even have two other brothers. There's a little one at home, and there was another one who isn't anymore. Very politely put. And then we have a father. And so this is the way Joseph gets more details out of them, by continuing his accusation of being a spy, forces them to produce more and more personal background to try to justify themselves. Okay, and then he says in verse 14, even after all that nice explanation, see, it's just like I said, you're spies. So this is how you're going to be tested. And so then he swears by Pharaoh's name, and you have to bring your youngest brother here. So send one of you, and the rest of you will be confined or will be imprisoned. And then we'll see if your words are true or not. So that would be pretty tough anyway, because I was trying to think the fastest they could possibly do that. I don't know, what do you think it would be? To go all the way home, get the younger brother, go all the way back down.
At least 2 weeks one direction.
Yeah. So 2 weeks in a jail in antiquity, it's not fun. I guess it depends what kind of jail. If it's the kind Joseph was in, seemed to be for the royal prisoners, a little bit different. But in an average jail, you're thrown into an old cistern. It is nasty. You might die of dysentery. I mean, it's bad.
Or dehydration.
Or dehydration. Presumably they'd give you water and a little bread. So they're going to get a little bit of punishment.
Well, they got 3 days, didn't they?
Well, that's the interesting thing.
Think,
so he says one thing, and then in the end they do another. He throws them in jail for 3 days.
All of them. Not just nine.
And he doesn't send one away immediately. But then again, at the end of... Oh, no, that's 18 again. In 18 it says, do this and you will live. So there is also this theme of doing a certain thing in order to live. Do this and you live, do this and you live. And I think that is also somehow connected to our Isaiah passage.
You You didn't answer my question about this unprotected land.
It says the nakedness of the land.
Oh, it's the naked. That's very good.
Yeah, you've come to see the nakedness. And, by the way, if you want to take it a step further, in the laws about sleeping with people, don't sleep with your aunt because you will reveal the nakedness, her nakedness. It means to sleep with her. So you could say you've come to rape the land. You could kind of go even more harshly. It's kind of, he's making a strong accusation.
Yeah, but then Sam go backwards to conceal or to cover the nakedness of Noah.
That's right.
Nakedness.
Well,
is it the same word?
Well, part of the
it is the same phrase, to cover the nakedness or reveal the nakedness, which leads me to interpret that whole story a little strong. I read between the lines, basically. I think the author is inviting us to read between the lines. But that's another story. We've technically already read it. Okay, so Gemma started talking about the whole spiritual aspect as well. And I think we see that not just in Isaiah, but all in Genesis, you have this theme of eating or drinking in order to live and choosing life. And we have the famous verse from Deuteronomy, but it's only famous after Jesus said it, which is?
Man shall not live by bread alone.
Right. So where is that from? Man shall not live by bread alone.
Deuteronomy 8.
There you go, Deuteronomy 8. But by what?
By every word that proceeds out of the mouth.
Everything. Everything or every word that comes out of the mouth of God.
Yeah.
So you have this idea of there's something more than just physical food. Even if you read through the story of the manna, it's very much a lot of the little idioms are pointing to something more than physical food. And what exactly the author is doing here in Genesis 42, I don't know. But it does strike me, if you've just read this story and then you read Isaiah, it really stands out. What confused me, though, is the whole story of Joseph's brothers leaving. Do you remember what happens? We're going to get to it next week or in the following weeks. Their money, their kesef, is returned to them. So they've essentially, they've shavu lelo mahir, or, you know, lelo kesef. They have just done exactly what Isaiah 55 is. So, why, though, that's not included in our Haftarah, it confuses me. Like, well, why didn't you continue the story then? Because it fits perfectly. But that, to me, because they're actually using this word that this is buying grain, you know? Buying grain without money. It's kind of like a impossibility. But to me, that's a picture of grace. And so it's the same thing that Joseph does to his brothers, even though he's talking harshly, he extends to them grace that they never deserved. And their reaction, what's their reaction? I guess we'll have to go forward in the story to see the reaction.
Fear.
They feared. They were in awe. Because they couldn't explain it.
No good deed goes unpunished.
Which verse are you reading in?
I'm not. It's just that if something so good has happened, something bad must be around the corner. Like,
right.
It can't be.
Is that a really biblical concept, Danny?
No. It's just when some, you know, there's no reason someone is being this nice to us except for, but that's a typical reaction of people
Yeah.
Or if you, if someone did right. this nice to me, it's because there's something evil is around the corner. You know?
I see. Don't trust anyone.
And also, well, I can't steal next week. Their response, even to Joseph's first accusation and saying they have to stay in prison until their brother comes, their response is, we're being punished for what we did. So
that's what I think that's a bit of a guilty conscience going on.
There's
back
a guilty here. Conscience.
Yeah.
And it's the first thing on their mind. Maybe they've done other bad things in their life too, but that, it happened many years ago and it's still right there in their memory.
Right.
You know, like, hey, this is why this is happening to us. So it seems to me that they've been struggling with a guilty conscience for a while now.
Maybe, especially because of Egypt comes up again.
I didn't hear what you said.
Sold them to Egypt, yeah. They sold his brother to Egypt, and now they're going to Egypt for help. And in verse 21, we get a little more information that we never got in the original story. When they say, surely we're being punished because of our brother, because we saw how distressed he was when he cried to us for mercy, but we refused to listen. That is why distress has come on us. And so crying for mercy, he cried for mercy and they didn't listen. And now they're crying for mercy, asking for food and saying, no, we're not slaves. You're falsely accusing us. And on that part, he hasn't yet revealed the end, but he has given them mercy by giving back their money. He's given them something they don't deserve at all.
Of course, they were right. Like, there was some trick in it all. Like, there was some, you know...
They were kind of being punished.
Yeah, they suspected that there was some kind of ploy in
right.
it, and that they were going to get screwed, and, you know, they're...
Yeah.
So it's the punishment, if we're going to put the two together, it's always the punishment plus grace. I mean, we do get punished for our sin. It does come back on us in whatever way whatever the situation is. And yet, God's word never returns to him empty. So if the great, I mean, and then we come to the Isaiah thing, which is there's always grace after grace, even though.
Well, that's the thing. They are, in fact, guilty.
Yeah.
And yet they're given food for free. And so it's a nice parallel to Isaiah where when he says, all you who are thirsty, it's kind of like the guilty.
But going back to what Danny said about there's a suspicion, his brothers have it basically their whole lives. Even up until Genesis 50, when their father dies,
oh, yeah, they still can't believe.
Now Joseph is going to really give it to him.
Right,
and
right.
starts to cry and say, what do you, you know, how can you think this?
Yeah.
They carry it their entire lives, even after they've been blessed. And
well, some Christians do that too.
Yeah. And not just Christians. I think people carry their guilt and their whatever and their lack of forgiveness or whatever it happens to be.
Well, he's saying even after they've been shown mercy, like they don't,
yeah.
they can't take it in.
No, because
Still
it's an act that you have to begin to really confess and deal with.
Mm-hmm. So this idea of being thirsty. Thirsty and hungry. You know, we think of the Beatitudes and hungry for righteousness, and this is the way we all want to be. But
it acknowledges the need.
It acknowledges a need, that's right. And, like, I need something I can't supply. But I was thinking about Deuteronomy, what Deuteronomy has to say about being thirsty. Where am I thinking about? Hold on.
What's the famous psalm? As the doe... seeks after you, O Lord. It's a famous psalm, very beginning. Come on, somebody.
42.
As the deer seeks for...
As the deer,
for,
yeah,
42.
It.
Yeah.
Is it 42?
Uh-huh. Okay. And, of course, water, we have a lot of parallels, water and the Holy Spirit. So
yeah.
You're thirsty for God,
right?
Right?
Out of your belly will flow rivers of living water.
Right. Well, that's in John. I was thinking about even in the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
But if you look at Deuteronomy 29:19, I just want to give you a slightly different perspective. Okay, let's start in verse 18. Beware that the heart of no man, woman, clan, or tribe among you turns away from the Lord our God today to pursue and serve the gods of those nations. Beware that there is among you no root producing poisonous and bitter fruit.
Where are you, Sean?
Deuteronomy 29, verse 18.
Sorry.
When such a person hears the words of this oath, he secretly blesses himself and says, I will have peace though I continue to walk with a stubborn spirit. Okay. This will destroy the watered ground with the parched. So you have to dissect this metaphor. This one person is secretly leaving God, right? And what is he saying? I'm going to be okay. Shalom yihieli. If I just do anything I want to do. Ki bishrirut libi elech. If I just do whatever I feel like it. Why? Why is he going to be okay? Because he's seconded to the well-watered stuff. And the well-watered ground is going to kind of spill over, so to speak, into the dry ground. So who's the well-watered ground here?
The well-watered ground is the person who hears the words of this of the Lord and does it.
Yeah, so it's a community of believers.
Right.
They're well-watered. They're getting water from God constantly. Who is the parched ground? It's not a trick question. It's. By the way, parched means thirsty. Tsme'a, the ground that is thirsty for water. It's this person who doesn't believe or is not going to follow God. And he says, I'm okay because I'm still part of the community. They all believe, they all practice, and they're going to carry it for me.
It ties up with the end of Isaiah 55. Because you'll go out with joy, be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills will burst in song before you, and the trees of the field will clap their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I never understood it, and I didn't really think of trees all waving their hands. But if you think of Psalm 1, it's the believer who's rooted by the waterside who is the tree that grows up into whatever, Psalm 1.
Right.
And so,
but back to here, the point is that the thirsty person is the one who doesn't believe,
right,
who has turned away from following God. It's the backslider,
yeah,
right?
I think that makes a lot more sense with Isaiah 55.
Right.
Because the whole thing is an indictment against people who are unwilling to come to Him.
Right.
Like, yeah, I mean the whole thing. So.
So it's the guilty people. It's the backsliders. Come you backsliders and get full of not just water and grain enough to live on, this shever idea, but even wine and milk for nothing, for free. So this is like a very practical picture of extravagant grace, I would say.
Yeah.
And that is, again, connected to the Joseph story where his brothers are sinners, right? They're the backslidden ones, in essence. And even they themselves admit.
Yeah.
What do they say about themselves? What they did against their brother Joseph. How do they describe it? We know that they sold him to the Ishmaelim who went down to Egypt. But how do they describe their own crime in Genesis 42?
And then they lied to their father.
Well, they lied also.
And they actually had a plan to kill him before they decided to sell.
But what do they specifically say when they say we're being punished. Look at verse 21. Okay, we're being punished because of our brother, because we saw how distressed he was when he cried out to us for mercy, but we refused to listen. This is why this distress has come on us. Reuben said to them, "Didn't I say to you, don't sin against the boy, but you wouldn't listen? So now we must pay for shedding his blood." Interesting, huh?
I've got accounting for his blood. It's really shedding, is it?
No, that's one interpretation. It's saying that they are guilty of his blood.
Right.
So, his blood is being asked for, is what it says. Vegam damo hine nidrash. It's being reckoned or asked for. So how you interpret that? But it's interesting to me because later interpretation does say that slavery, selling your brother to slavery, is equated with murder. You've essentially murdered his prospects.
Yeah.
Even his descendants will then, you know, be stuck. And so if you have this idea, even though they didn't physically kill him, they metaphorically did.
Yeah.
And so who is talking here? Is it Reuben? Yeah, Reuben. He acknowledges that what they did is basically as serious as murder, because his blood is being accounted for. And so...
And interestingly, I mean, Reuben was the one who tried to stop it all.
Right.
And yet,
well,
he's not really separating himself from the sin of the whole. He's saying a little bit, "I told you so."
We'll keep reading this story. It's very fascinating. It's exceptional for its detail in the Bible. It reads much more like a longer novella like Esther than some of the other stories. You have a lot of dialogue, and we get a lot of words from Reuben and Judah, both talking to their father, and both swearing on their kids and on whatever. And it's very interesting because Jacob really doesn't believe them. He's like, kind of like, he's nodding and like, "No. You're still not going to take Benjamin. Only when they really run out of food will he eventually send them back." So I like that connection, even though it's just past our parasha. This idea of guilty, being thirsty. Like, do you guys all know worship songs about being thirsty? "Is anyone thirsty? Let them come to me and drink." Like, "Oh, give us a thirst for you, Lord." You know, it's to be spiritual is to be thirsty, right? But actually to be thirsty is to acknowledge that you lack. You are guilty. You do not have it. You know? And it's those thirsty people that God's calling and saying, "You understand, you get it, because it's grace." And it's the people who understand that they lack that that can receive the grace.
You're drawing a contrast between, like, the definition of thirsty being not just someone who wants to be holy, but one who acknowledges his messed upness.
Yeah.
Right.
To be thirsty is not to be spiritual and to realize, I guess it's a very nuanced thing I'm trying to say, and maybe I can't convey
it
quite well.
I want to be in a state of spiritual nirvana, but I'm recognizing that I'm really messed up, and I need to be helped. I need to be saved.
Because a lot of Christians' concept of spirituality is very what's the word I'm looking for?
I want to say
shallow.
Well, let's all go into ruin, sing, and float.
Yeah, or like I'm doing all this, but now I want to be the next level up. I want to be thirstier. Like, they use these terms as if it's a glorious term. Like, aren't I great and spiritual because I'm thirsty? Where it's actually like, it's the opposite of glorious. It's still true. It's still good. We are all thirsty, right? But I guess it's the attitude I'm thinking about.
Like, recognizing your mire and your muck that you're in.
Right. Recognizing just how much you lack.
Yeah.
I get into a state of, Lord, I am just so sorry that I'm so stuck on this, 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 and this. I really want more of you today. I mean, that's how I get into it.
I guess, Gary, it is like what you're saying. It's not a trite statement to say you're thirsty. To say you're thirsty is acknowledging that you are a sinner and you are guilty. And you have left God in some way or another.
Yeah.
Like the Deuteronomy 29:18-19. And those are the people God is calling.
It's actually embarrassing.
It's embarrassing, yeah. There you go.
Yeah, I think the metaphor is used differently in the New Testament. I think, like, it would be better to keep those.
Are you sure?
I think. I mean, it's like hunger and thirst for righteousness. You know, to always want more of that seems to be a good thing. But in Deuteronomy,
well, the parallels of the Beatitudes,
when
those who are poor in spirit, the meek.
When Jesus, when you look at what he was doing, he's hanging out with people who were not the righteous. He said, "I've come to call the lost sheep of Israel." Those are not the people. Oh Lord, I'm thirsty for you. You know, they're like, "Hey, you know, I'm a tax collector. What should I do?"
On any level, blessed are those who mourn. I mean, they will be comforted. Very nice. But we're not talking, we're talking about what it is to mourn, what it is to grieve, maybe to grieve for your sin. It's not just conveniently just somebody who's just died. It's to grieve about the situation that one's in. And then once you come to that, then you do know the comfort.
Because I think even in the Beatitudes, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, those who acknowledge that they really have a lack of righteousness.
Yeah.
Jesus is calling them blessed.
I guess in the Deuteronomy passage, though, to be like the parched ground is not good. I mean, the guy doesn't necessarily recognize he's the parched ground. He just says, like, oh, well, I'll be... Well,
he kind of does. He kind of
does.
But he thinks it's okay. It'll be covered by...
And the next
verse
says that God won't forgive him.
Right.
So, like, it seems like...
Okay.
And, you know, the root of bitterness is using the New Testament as a reference to always being bad. So,
not... I don't know.
In Hebrews 12.
Well, what about in Acts 8? When Peter says, pray that the Lord, if he could forgive you. Remember to Simon the sorcerer? Because basically he wanted power without wanting God. And so Peter is accusing him, saying, you're like this person back there who has left God. You're not really following God. And pray that the Lord could forgive you. He's referring to Deuteronomy 29:19, where God says, you know, I'm not going to forgive that person who willfully does what they want. But I don't think that Peter was saying it's impossible for him to be forgiven. He was making a statement to get him to go back and read Deuteronomy and then really repent. So I'm not sure that the root of bitterness is impossible to turn around, you know?
I think, to clarify that, it's the magician is not asking for power without God, but he's
asking for control.
Exactly. He wants power. His God is a God of power, not a God of righteousness. And that's the distinction.
He wants it on his terms.
He wants it on his terms. He wants to have the power. And
control.
So he thinks he would be linking up with God and that God is happy to exude power. That was, you know, he's missing the point, but I say that because there's a lot of people today that want power, and they think that's God. They think that God is the God of power, not the God of goodness and justice.
Or both. Grace as well. I mean,
yes.
He's also a God of power. Don't let's belittle him.
Well, the thing is, like we read in the Isaiah passage, my thoughts are not your
thoughts. That's right.
Like, I understand things better than you. And so if you had the power, you think you're doing the ultimate good, but in the end you'll find out you didn't. Like, we can't control God, because if we're trying to control him, we're essentially saying that we're as good as him.
That's why trust is so important.
Yeah. So So, yeah, so there's some interesting things to chew on, no pun intended. Food and wine.
It's a good pun.
And what it means to be thirsty. But the answer is the same. Whether we realize it or not, we are the guilty ones. We are the wicked, like in, what is it, Pulp Fiction? What does he say in Pulp Fiction?
I am the wicked?
The wicked, yeah. The guy who thinks he's the enforcer of all righteousness finds out he is the wicked. So that is true whether we realize it or not. And the antidote to that is this life-giving that comes from God. And it's crazily free. I think that's the nice connection between the two things. If anyone didn't deserve it, it was Joseph's brothers, and they ended up getting grain and their money back. And that's what Isaiah is talking about, that even these guilty people get full grace and then some. You know, they get wine on top of the water.
But they have to come and buy it for free.
Right. They have to acknowledge that it's not them.
Yeah, that's important what Gary just said. You come and buy it for free. I mean, it's an obvious expression.
You buy it for free. Exactly, that's what he's saying. Yeah. Buy it for free.
Yeah.
Buy it without money. So, like, it's emphasizing this paradox. Because you can't buy it for free. Did anyone find other connections? Between the two verses? Between Isaiah 55 and Joseph 42? Joseph. Genesis 42. Okay. Gary's saying there's no time.
I think he's right.
All right. So maybe I will read 1 Peter 2:1. So get rid of all evil and all deceit and hypocrisy and envy and all slander. And yearn like newborn infants for pure spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow up to salvation, if you have experienced the Lord's kindness.
That's great.
Do you know what the Greek word is there?
For which one?
Kindness.
Yeah. Ki erevsaste oti Christos o Kyrios. Because you have tasted that the Lord is good, it says.
Christos, nice.
Christos.
So it's quoting Isaiah 55.
Yeah, you have, you know when it says, yeah, when it says taste and see that the Lord is good,
yeah.
You have tasted that the Lord is good. In my translation, you have experienced the Lord's kindness.
Yeah,
I guess they want to get rid of the metaphor.
It's terrible.
So that it's, but it does have a note that says a quotation from Psalm 34:8.
It's also connected to Isaiah 55 too.
Well, yeah, this because it's the same type of metaphor.
Yeah.
To experience, I think it has the idea here of experiencing God's goodness even when you don't deserve it. The water and the bread that keeps you alive, and even milk and wine.
But eating and drinking and tasting, that's the connection.
Right.
Right. Which that translation, unfortunately, wiped out.
The connection.
Yeah.
Well, but it, yeah, it does at least have...
You don't have that whole mouth sensation in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it gets the gist, but it's, you still feel the pump in the text.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least you also have the mention of the milk. sincerity, where that actually connects back to Joseph. His brothers keep saying, no, we're sincere, we're honest people, we're kenim. And yet they know they're not actually honest people deep down inside. All right, so let's acknowledge our thirstiness and go downstairs. The worship service will be starting in a couple minutes.
Hallelujah.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.